This time of year, you're going to find me jigging for crappies off my father-in-law's boat, celebrating a successful turkey hunt, or just sitting on the back deck watching time go by with a quality cigar from Thompson Cigar. Thompson Cigar has been around since 1915, offering the widest array of cigars and cigar accessories at very affordable prices. Thompson Cigar offers your favorite brands like Swisher Sweets, Cohiba, Backwoods, and Monte Cristo shipped fresh directly to your door. Also, be sure to check out their 5-pack fever deals and join their value club for big savings. Visit thompsoncigar.com and enter the discount code SE at checkout for 20% off of all orders over $75. Thompson Cigar, quality cigars at affordable prices. You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable. This episode of the Sportsman's Empire is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. Since 1952, Interstate Batteries has been evoking compassion and a trustworthy spirit into the surrounding communities. Interstate Batteries is a mission-driven company fueled by purpose and guided by their values. If you need help locating a specific battery, stop into your local Interstate Batteries retail store and speak with a battery specialist. They even offer cell phone repairs. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
We're leaving today and entering a world of Mickey Mouse waving, princess meeting and greeting, lightsaber clashing, the Twilight Zone Tower of Terror dropping, Banshee flying, Space Mountain launching, galaxy rewinding, what is the whole deck with galaxy rewinding, fireworks igniting, world of other worlds. For whatever you love, infinite worlds await at the most magical place on Earth, Walt Disney World Resort.
From athletic stuff like a full court pickup game, swish, to athletic-ish stuff like a half mile stroll. Get those steps in. Head to Sierra or Sierra.com for the brands you want at the prices that let you do it all. From athletic to athletic-ish, Sierra's got it.
Two Good & Co. coffee creamers are made with farm fresh cream, real milk, and contain 3 grams of sugar per serving. That's 40% less than the 5 grams per serving in leading traditional coffee creamers for a rich, delicious experience. Whether you enjoy your coffee hot, cold, bold, or frothy, Two Good coffee creamers make every sip a good one. Two Good coffee creamers, real goodness in every sip. Find them at your local Kroger in the creamer aisle.
You're listening to The Western Rookie, a hunting podcast full of tips, tricks, and strategies from seasoned Western hunters. There are plenty of opportunities out there. We just need to learn how to take on the challenges.
Hunting is completely different up there.
I harvested 26 big game animals.
You can fool their eyes, but you can't fool their nose.
300 yards back to the road turned into 3 miles back the other way.
It's always cool seeing new hunters go and harvest an animal.
I don't know what to expect.
If there's anybody I want in the woods with me, it'll be you.
Welcome back to another Western Rookie Podcast brought to you by Go Hunt. Like always, I'm your host, Brian Krebs, and today we have one of my good digital buddies, Dwayne Jones. We haven't met in person yet, but we're back on the podcast, which only means one thing, that it is now shed season.
Shed season is here.
Shed season is here. Busted out the old shed season cap. I think I got it crushed, though. I think it got crushed in a bag.
I was going to say, it looks like it's either you've really put it through its paces or something.
I think this hat has a couple hundred miles on it.
Yeah, nothing wrong with that.
And a few dozen gym lifts. It started becoming my gym hat, too.
Yeah, that happens to the best of us. I swear I go through hats like crazy because of that. I find a hat that I really like. And then I wear it to the gym once or twice, and then it's like white and sweat stained and disgusting and has to be retired. So
you know what's a good milestone, though? When you finally feel like you're able to wear one of your old favorite hats to the gym.
Yeah, I agree. Like,
so I really like the Sitka Truckers.
Yep.
They fit my head really good, but I've split two of the snapbacks. They split down the middle on me.
Wow.
And so one of them I electrical taped back together. And people see it and comment all the time on my comments because I'm always wearing my hat backwards. And it's like not even centered. It's like offset a little bit.
Yeah.
Just did electrical tape. They'll be like, I'll be like, do you know there's a hack for your Wyoming elk applications? And the comments will be like, did you know there's a hack for keeping your hat together? It's electrical tape.
Yeah, exactly.
But that one got gross from hunting. And so I'm like, I sweat all day long in this in Nebraska hunting. So I might as well just wear it to the gym now. So yeah, I got to retire. Absolutely. It's not retired. It's hitting its golden years.
That's right. Yeah. Yep. Love it. Yeah. Setting PRs.
Setting PRs. So, yeah, no, good hats are one. This one is favorite. And this one actually came, I don't know why, but it came with like an angled curl on it. It's starting to round out now. But when I first got it, it was like a stop sign. And I was like, it actually looks kind of good. I don't know.
Yeah, I like it.
So I rocked it. And then I convinced Dan Matthews to do the same thing on our shed hunt to New Mexico. Yeah.
Love it.
Yeah.
How was that?
Oh, dude, it was a blast. I'm trying to get out there again this year. So I missed last year, but we got like an elk shed camp going with Dan Matthews, Chris Parsons, Stephen Walker, all friends of the podcast. Stephen kind of hosts. He's a huge shed hunter out west. And, dude, it's so much fun. It's like I don't turkey hunt, but I imagine it's like turkey camp. Where like no one really cares.
Yeah. It sounds like bucket list. That sounds awesome.
Yeah. It sounds really good. I would love to do like a shed hunt. I would want to do two a year. I'd want to do a shed hunt, like a creator shed hunt, like friends of the podcast type thing. Yep. Anyone kind of like open invite. I'd probably want to like vet people just to make sure like no cuckoo show up.
Yeah.
But TJ, all the friends that we've had on the podcast, just like meet up somewhere that's got plenty of land to walk and shed hunt.
We're actually hoping and kind of have plans to do something kind of like that maybe next year, as soon as next year. So
yeah,
excited about that. Yeah.
I've got a couple of, spots that could definitely sustain that much pressure.
Yeah. Yeah. So here we're the county TJ and I live in, there are two reservoir properties, so man-made reservoirs, but there's like, I want to say there's like 12 or 15,000 acres that surround the reservoirs that are all public ground, and they do a good job. It's managed pretty well. They leave crops standing every year, grain standing and stuff like that, and like fortunately, there's really not a ton of people that shed hunt around here, and we've talked about potentially next year doing like a basically hosting a shed season event. Like we'd love to do one in the Midwest, one in the West, where it might be like a weekend or a 3-day thing where it's invite only. And we have some of our partners do like breakout camps.
Yeah.
So if we could get like Jeremy Moore to do like, training labs to find sheds. We have like some guys from Onyx there talking about how to use mapping, different stuff like that where you could break out and kind of whatever appeals to you, you could go to in day one. And then like day two, day three, we literally just go out, break out into groups and go find sheds.
Dude, that'd be awesome. I have two places right off the top of my head that I've had both places I've done 20 antler weekends.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
It would be pretty cool. Yeah.
It'd be incredible.
Yeah, Steven, my gosh, we got to get you tied up with Steven Walker because I think his record is 750 in his camp in a season. So, that's like, insane. When he brings us out and we find him, like, he counts those towards his, like, group total.
Yeah.
It's still 700, and most of them are him and his son.
Absolutely insane. I can't imagine that.
And they're all mostly elk sheds.
I won't find 750 sheds in my life, probably.
No, you will.
That's a lot, dude.
I'm already at 150.
Are you really?
Yeah. But it comes in big years and low years. Like last year, I found two deadheads.
It was a
pretty rough year. The year before that, I found 46.
Yeah. I've had a bunch of like 20 some years. I don't know if I've ever found 30, but it's also like I've also just typically focused on farms that we hunt here.
Yeah.
And like I have a few, we got a few permission pieces where you go and, you know, you might find like a good farm here, you may find a dozen sheds on, but still like a 30 shed year for me would be huge. So it's going to take a lot of years to get 750.
Well, the simple math would tell us 37 and a half.
That's right. Exactly.
Yeah. and you're almost but if you start traveling, like I hear you, because if I only counted farms that I could hunt, I'd have 5-6 sheds. Like our family farms, just, and I talk about a lot on the podcast, like, just because you got a good hunting farm doesn't mean you have a good shed hunting farm. It's 100%. Really interesting how that works. Like, you can have farms where you shoot good bucks every year. Like, everyone's got deer activity. But when it comes to shed season, especially in, like, the Midwest or the East, it's very hit or miss. In the West, I feel like it's a little bit different in a couple ways. But just, like here in Minnesota, there's so much habitat around, and it's all flat. No one migrates. It all depends on the food source. And if you don't have that food source, I feel like we do have migration patterns, as crazy as it sounds, even though I just said they don't migrate. But I think they find, like, I think there's parent groups or doe groups that know where the best food is in the winter. And so, like, they might not migrate like the mule deer do, but they bump over 4 farms.
Yeah.
And they do it every year.
Yeah, and not only that, like, I'm experiencing it here on my home farm. It's actually been really super frustrating because we put so much work into it. But, like, the first year here, like, the first full year that I had, every year we've bought back grain, and I've always had food plots, and I work with Big Time, so obviously we supplemental feed all off-season, you know, summer, shed season, all of it. And so, you know, the very first year we had this, I found 9 sheds between my dad's, mine, and the neighbors that we lease, which was okay, but still, like, the number of bucks we had wasn't amazing. Last year, I think I found 2. This year so far, I've only found 1, and it was one from last year. But, like, dude, I could send you pictures where there are 15, I would say, safely say 15 bucks that are here every day. Like, no joke. They're here on feed every single day. But the problem that I face is the neighbor to the west of me just has 22 acres. And even though my ground, like, we've improved bedding and made it good, like, in order to keep feed out, I'm going in there at least once a week. And that dude doesn't touch his property at all whatsoever from December until turkey season. And they know it. So it's super thick, grown up with invasives. And what they do is they bed in there because they're never, ever pressured. And then they come here to feed. And so I have to hope that they shed here when they're here at night feeding, basically. Otherwise, they're over there. And so, again, like, but in the rut, this place is magical. So just because your farm is great to hunt doesn't mean you're going to find a pile of sheds. And we've found that, and it's infuriating. Just tonight, my wife and I were watching one of the 4-year-olds right here out the 50 yards out my window, and he shed out right now. And I've tried and tried and tried to find the sheds, and I really think they're on the neighbor. I cannot find them.
Yeah, I wonder. So you said you're out there every week to keep feed out.
Yeah, typically once a week I drive in, and I try to do it smart. Like, I feel like they've kind of learned where I take the same path every time. Mm-hmm. And drive the side-by-side nice and slow, leave it run while we feed and leave. And there's a lot of times where I'll leave and 3 minutes later there's deer on the feed.
Yeah.
But, like, typically it's not the big deer. It's the does and fawns.
Yeah.
And so I don't know exactly what's happening, to be truthful with you. I just know they're here all evening, all night, in the morning, and then you'll see that they head back west to bed. And for whatever reason, we're not finding their sheds. Like,
do you have a drone?
I do have a drone.
How much snow do you guys have?
Right now, enough you could see trails.
Yeah, I'd throw that sucker up there and see, like, how long your main trail is, like the interstate, right? Before you, like, they're going to get to county roads before they hit their bed.
Yeah.
But, like, how long is the interstate? How long is the highway before they start getting to county roads? Like, if their interstate goes all the way to the neighbors, it's like, yeah, they're definitely, they're just, like, and that feed window, you probably know, but it's because you got the pictures. Because the camera runs all night long, but I feel like especially those mature bucks, that feed window is short. Like, it's like each buck's probably, how long do you think each buck's on your feeder? Is it just like an hour or two?
Well, so here's the thing. This is another thing that I've really had to learn through doing all this work here is no matter how much feed I put out, I would say it makes up 10 to 20% of their diet.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter how many hundreds of thousands of pounds of it I put out. they're going to eat other stuff. Like that's not going to be their sole focus. They'll go and they'll hit, like I have a 2-acre clover plot that there's not much there yet, but they're still picking at it. Tonight they came up here and hit this brassica plot. There's still bulbs laying out there. They're hitting browse. They're going up to the neighbors north of me that has winter wheat. Like it doesn't like literally a couple weeks ago, I took a 2,000-pound bulk tote of big time and spread it all over the field. And they come and hit it for 10, 15 minutes, and then they go to the next thing.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just hard. I feel like, and I saw some of your posts, you're definitely doing the social pressure mitigation method. You know, you're trying to spread that out instead of one feeder. I don't have a huge deer herd here. So I just built a hay feeder out of an IBC tote.
I saw that. That was actually really cool. Yeah.
I'm going to tweak it a little bit. They're not hitting it as hard as I want, but they're just focused on the corn, I think. I think the corn is just like candy to them, and the hay is like your vegetables.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I kind of wonder, though, to your point, if you have to break some genetic or hereditary like patterns and cycles. Those big mature bucks, they know where they've been surviving all these years. And yeah, they come in and they hit your food, but they haven't relocated their winter bedding yet, maybe. I'm just curious if like when you see a fawn or a one-year-old, is that when you switch it? And they're like, that doe is going to probably relocate faster because she's got more needs than the bucks do right now. Mm-hmm. She's feeding a growing baby. Her fawns are growing as well. I wonder if that will start to change, and like it takes like basically 4 years for you to change a migration pattern in the winter.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I've also found that like the last 3 or 4 years in a row, we've bought back an acre of grain, which, it's gone back and forth between corn and beans. And every year, this year included, they've smoked that acre of grain by mid-January.
Yeah.
So we actually just enrolled, my backfield is 37 acres, and we enrolled it all in CRP to put it in warm season grasses, and I'm going to plant a bunch of diversity pockets of trees back there. With that, you can leave 10% of it can be food plots. So I can do 3.7 acres and feed, and I left a couple acre food plot out of it. So we'll have about almost 6 acres back there next year, which I think will make a huge difference. Because they won't, I really don't think they'll eat that stuff completely gone. I think it'll last way much longer, like potentially through the winter.
Yeah. So
that'll help too. Like once they smoke those beans and they're all gone and the only thing we have here is supplemental feed, it definitely changes things quite a bit. They're forced to go find other food sources. They can't solely rely on that. So hopefully that changes and helps a little bit too.
Yeah, and the thermal cover is a big part of it because they will walk a long ways to get feed because they're not cold when they're walking, they're up and moving, but they will bed down where the best thermal cover is as well.
I'm super excited for that. It's an awesome mix. We have it in this right here in front of the house. We have 3 or 4 acres of it, and even year two, it's like 7 feet tall, and it's awesome. So like we get 3, 4, 5 years down the road where some of these pines are 5, 6 feet tall and surrounded by warm seasons, like I should definitely be finding more sheds than a couple every year. Definitely.
Yeah. One of the things that I'm big on that we're trying to do this year. So our big challenge, we have tons of cover and probably decent thermal cover. Cause it's like thick, thick. It's either cattails. We got some cattails. We have tons of willow, like tons and tons of willow. So enough to cut the wind, but a lot of light penetration, which is kind of the best mix.
Yeah.
So I think we have tons of thermal cover around. And the closest egg to us. Hey, folks. Application season is finally wrapped up, and I hope each and every one of you has a tag for this fall. And by now, you should be starting to think about your e-scouting plans. I'm working on mine as we speak for my Western hunts. And it's actually one of my favorite parts of the entire season, and that's because of Go Hunt Insider. Go Hunt has everything I need to plan an amazing experience this fall. I always start with filtering 2.0 to read up on what my unit has to offer, what the access is like, what the local buzz is. I look at the trophy potential and the harvest rates, and I take all of that information from filtering 2.0, and I move over to Go Hunt Maps, and that is where things get exciting. I'm finding glassing knobs with the 3D mapping features. I'm using the terrain analysis, something that's new you might not have seen yet, where I can look at slopes. I can see which slope is facing which directions, how steep it is, what the elevation is. It's a super cool feature, and it's helping me plan out my routes. I turn on all the water layers, making sure I understand where springs and guzzlers are, where there's creek beds. I'm looking at access points, roadways, you name it. They have it for planning an awesome hunt. I'm storing all of that information in a single hunt plan so I can keep all of my information organized and there's not a bunch of icons on my screen every time I open up my app. There's a reason why I've used Go Hunt Insider to do my e-scouting and plan every single Western hunt I've ever gone on. And it's because it is truly the best resource for the Western hunter. Head over to GoHunt.com and check out all the tools and resources you get with your Insider membership, and you'll see why it's my favorite tool for punching tags. And the best part is, when you use the code WESTERN, they're going to give you $50. That's right, they're going to give you a $50 credit to the gear shop that has some of the best hunting and backpacking gear on the market. So no matter if you're a brand new hunter or a Western veteran, I promise you there's something in the gear shop that'll catch your eye. Head over to GoHunt.com, check it out. Don't forget to use the code WESTERN and start getting your e-scouting plans together because it's going to be hunting season before you know it. Is 3 miles in any direction. There's nobody doing substantial food plotting around in any direction. And so we have three miles in the one direction. We have a 3,000-acre preserve, university research facility. So stable population there. Bordering my property on the one side is a DNR orphanage, and she takes in like 30 abandoned fawns every year, feeds them until they can hop her low fence, and then they're just released into the wild. And her property boundary connects to mine.
That's awesome.
So we have a constant supply of not only fresh deer but different genetics because they're coming from like a 3-county area.
Sounds like an incredible opportunity, honestly.
So the problem is 35 of our 40 acres is really low, like relatively, like average is probably at the water table.
Yep.
So I got to really figure out some ways. But one of the things that I'm so excited about, I think pivot to basically lining all of my food plots with crab apple trees.
Yeah.
So I did the math for like virtually zero footprint. These trees can produce up to like 200 pounds of feed a year, especially if you get the crab apples that have like bigger ones. Some of them are like berries, and that's like, I don't know if, I mean, yeah, they'll probably eat it, but I'm looking for like those ones that are like an inch, like golf balls.
Absolutely. Yep.
They hold their fruit throughout the winter. They're persistent. So they'll drop like very slowly. But if you drive around, like now that I'm on this crab apple kick, I'm picking up crab apple trees all over the place. Yeah. Like, oh, that's crab apple. That's crab apple. Right. Oh, that one's a big crab apple. They're all full still. They're loaded. Yeah. And they're going to start dropping like right now, which almost might be too late for shed season. But still, if you get those crab apple trees to slowly drop in, it's like a free 200 pounds of food per tree that the deer cannot eat until late winter.
Sounds pretty ideal to me.
And you can't, like, if you're doing a big destination plot, like, what else are you going to line your food plot with?
Yeah, right. Yeah, why not?
Like, why not? Yeah, you're just going to transition back to, like, your warm season grasses. Like, you put a tree line down. Yep. You know, you could do three rows to really block it off, and then the deer have, a visual barrier as well. You could create, if you're doing that big destination plot, if you've been looking into the big-time food plotters that are now, like, taking their three-acre fields and breaking them into, like, 12 sections.
Right. Yeah.
Just to get, because they'll say, you'll have two doe groups in a three-acre field. Yep. But if you break that into 12, quarter-acre fields, you'll have 12 doe groups in it.
Right.
And then your mature bucks check each one of those. This one, I don't know who it was. It might have been Don Higgins was giving a presentation. He's like, I did some research, and I did a research project. Before I did this, the average time one of my mature bucks was in my food plot was, 3.5 minutes.
Yeah.
And when I broke it into 13, it jumped to 75 minutes.
That's pretty wild.
And so, yeah, dude, there's just so many things where I'm like, yeah, it's like free land. Like, you put that tree right on the edge. You didn't take up any of your acres for your food plot.
Yep. Yeah, we've done – I haven't looked at crab apples, but we've done a fair amount of that with chestnuts and persimmons and apple trees and pear trees and all that kind of stuff. So
I want all of those in the yard for like our homestead. But the crab apple, I think the couple key differences is that crab apples are way more durable than an apple tree.
Yeah.
Like apple trees, you got to fight every year to keep those suckers alive and straight and the branches break. And the crab apples are like, it's like, I think it's like wheat. Like wheat will grow in the back of your truck. Like if you have a little bit of water, your extra seed will be germinating. I think that's what the crab apples will do from my experiences. And they do a more consistently have those bumper crops. Like every year they produce versus apple trees. It's like good year, bad year, good year, bad year.
Yep.
So that's what I think I've heard so far. Plus they're drastically cheaper.
Yeah, well, I'm sure.
Your soil water conservation district probably does a tree sale and they're probably $2 a piece.
Yeah, they do. I need to look at it because I think I have like 600 trees coming now. So
yeah,
if they've got them, might not be a bad idea to throw a handful of them on there and give it a shot. That's for sure.
Yeah, I built a wagon to do a water wagon and like a 275 gallon tank on top of it. So I got the plans working. We got a big dead hill area in our woods. We have like 5 acres of woods and a pocket of oak wilt hit. So it basically opened up like a half acre.
Yeah.
So I'm going to plant crab apple trees in that half acre in lines from like my blinds, basically make shooting lanes divided by these crab apples. And then I'm going to plant underneath it a no-till like clover plot.
Yeah. Yeah.
But those ones, I kind of want those to drop earlier. So I might have to pick different trees. Like persimmons drop early. Like those are a good bow hunting tree.
Yep. Yeah. I'm sure there's probably different varieties. Just like with persimmons, that you can get August drop, September drop, October drop, you know, they have different varieties that'll drop at different times. So that could be ideal too.
Yeah. That's, I'm hoping so. Cause that would be, that's kind of my new thing is like, how can I get these trees to produce for me so I can have better shed hunting and then figure out the whole water drainage thing.
Yep. Absolutely. I was curious to see like where you were at with your farm. Cause you had basically just got it. I think you'd only walked it one time the last time we podcast.
Yeah. I don't shed hunt it very often cause of the, poison sumac.
Yeah.
It's, gets a little gnarly. And last year we had such a crazy winter, where we didn't get any snow at all, like grass still, I mean, frozen, but tundra up until March 20th, we hit some like, I think we had a 5-inch snow and we had our number one hit lister show up. He was still holding March 24th. And then I think he dropped not too long after that. And then it was like, boom, summer. And the problem is our swamp melted too fast. Like we didn't have any snow. It's so hard to hunt. It's like literally Alaskan brush, like Alaskan backcountry, so thick, like zero visibility. So I'm like banking on heavier snow years where I can follow those good trails and shed hunt the good trails.
Down and
Yeah, but when it melted so fast, it was like, it's like sometimes it gets to be like a foot of water over a foot of muck.
Oh, wow.
And so it's like, even if there was a shed there, it's probably underwater.
Right.
And so that's, I'm still learning that. And so I think some of these plots will help. The feed yard that we're doing in the backyard is going to help. I think if we can get these trees in that woods plot opened up, I'm still logging. I'm still cutting out the dead oak and bringing those out. I think that'll help. But then I got these plans for a southeast corner. Our 40 is perfectly square. It's a square 40. In the southeast corner, we've got like 3 acres of cattails. And then right above that, it transitions to willow. And in that transition line, I'm going to make like a four-legged turkey foot.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So the middle sector is going to be like a quarter or a third of an acre, and it's going to be 40 yards. So I'm going to put a blind in the corner, 40-yard bow shot. I'm going to put two scrape trees at 25 yards. So they'd like hit one, walk to the other broadside, stop them on their way to the second. And then each like sector is going to be 100 yards. So 140 yards to the back of the sector. And I'm shooting a long range muzzleloader now in our shotgun zone because it's legal. And the last buck I shot actually, oh no, he's in the shop. 175 yards, dropped him in his tracks.
Yeah. Heck yeah.
That's awesome. It's crazy to like take a muzzleloader and dial it and be like,
Phew. No, that's sweet.
I had a 6-inch group at 300 on the paper with it.
You can't beat that.
No, especially because it's shotgun zone where we
are. Right. Yeah.
So, and then I want to line each of those sectors with fruit trees, but I got approval from our person that's in charge of the LGU to dig. Like I told her I wanted to dig waterfall breeding ponds. But really what I want is the fill to make mounds for the trees so they keep them out of the water. And it's, I feel like it's just going to be like so cool if I can actually pull it off in that area.
Yeah, that'd be awesome.
And then in that, so that's going to be in this, like right in the willows, but right below that in the cattails, I'm going to dig some more of those waterfall breeding ponds. It's like, I actually do, would be cool to like help the duck population.
Yeah.
I don't think ducks are like doing awesome right now.
Definitely not.
So, but then I'm going to make some mounds from these like 10 by 20 foot ponds that I'm going to dig and make like a 10 by 20 foot mound. And then on one side, I'm going to plant pines like you're planting. And on the other side, I'm going to plant a maple. So, in the winter, I'm going to try cedar. I think cedar is probably one of the densest pines to like cut wind and be like a thermal backstop. White pine. I know a lot of people love white pine, but some of the whites I see, like they don't really stop much of anything.
No, they're pretty open for sure.
Yeah. So I'm thinking like cedars on the northwest corner to block wind and have a thermal barrier, and then a maple on the south for in the summer to shade that mound and just basically create a bunch of like buck bedding islands.
Yeah, that sounds awesome.
And so I'm hopeful. I'm like, that could be sweet. The only worry I have is like, what's my access going to be to hunt the food plot? Because I'm basically going to have to walk right in between the food plot and the buck beds. And the food plot's going to set up for like a northwest wind, so my wind would blow right to that buck bed. So that, I don't know if like, do I go all the way around? Do I like weasel my way through the cattails underneath them?
Yeah.
I don't know. But those mounds, I think, could be like shed hunt. Like, go check each mound for sure.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There's no question. That's, do you guys have a decent amount of cedars up there?
We have not like you would expect, or not like you would see in like Nebraska and Kansas. Yeah. Not like that. We have most of them are probably ornamental, like someone planted them in their yard. We don't have a lot of natural cedar. We have tamaracks all over there, but I don't think tamaracks are going to do anything for me.
Yeah, that's like it's not too different here, really. You see cedars like in the ditches of highways and stuff like that, but we don't have like, you know, you go out to Iowa and they have cedar eradication programs and stuff. Yeah. But here, like I absolutely love cedars. So
yeah,
and I would have some of them. And so I've transplanted them all over the place just so we have some.
Yeah. And I would plant probably one or two. I'd probably plant two and let them grow. But then I would probably actually like either trim them, top them, and like make them bushy. Or I might honestly just be like, start one when he gets to be like five, start another one. And then when the one is at 10 and he's like starting to self prune, cut him out. And now we got, you know what I mean? Like, just keep doing this because I don't want them to get big and tall and self prune all their bottom branches.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
I want it to be that bush.
I feel like cedars are pretty good about staying bushy like that. I actually was just watching, I think it was from a year or so ago, but Lee Lukoski was reclaiming a buck bedding area. Have you seen that? Where no, it was in CRP for years. And so they were forced to mow it, and it stayed, you know, native warm season grasses, and there were cedars here and there. And when it went out of CRP, they stopped mowing it, and it just grew up, and it got so thick deer couldn't even navigate it.
Yeah.
So they went in and mulched the thing, and we're going to plant natives back in there and then replant some cedars. And he was saying he's never had a really great farm that didn't have cedars. Never. Every farm that they've ever had that was really great had cedars on it. And so he was saying, like, he leaves them spaced out enough to where you can mow between them. But having those little pockets of thermal cover with warm seasons in between, like, you just can't beat it.
Yeah, we planted a bunch of cedars on one of our farms, one of our family farms. Actually, a couple of them have a bunch of cedar plantings and pine plantings with CRP and warm season grasses. And we still don't find sheds, but I think that's kind of a food source issue. We just don't have enough food plots that make it through the winter. So I'm kind of changing everything. Like, I'm getting away from monocrop food plotting. It seems like it's so hit or miss, especially the corn and the soybeans on our scale. Like, we don't have enough to keep soybeans alive. The fences work great, but they take so much maintenance, and I live 2 hours away.
Yep.
Corn is so expensive to grow. So I think I'm going to switch to more of like a Dr. Woods crimp buffalo method style.
Yeah,
try that. Yep. But yeah, I'm excited. Hopefully I can figure that out. And then I would probably do like three feed stations across the farm.
Yeah.
Just to increase, like, I don't know, what's the limit? What's the carrying capacity in the winter for my farm?
Yeah.
We have deer throughout the day now.
Yeah. No, it makes such a huge difference. I sent you a couple pictures a little bit ago. I texted them to you from where I spread that feed out in the big field.
Oh yeah.
So there's that. And then I run a feeder in a little food plot that's in the middle of my woods.
Yeah.
And there's been times here in the last week where I'll have 33 to 35 deer out there in the big field, and they'll be 120 yards away on this feeder. Like it seems like you can never have too much food. The more food you have, the more you'll pull in deer, and like you'd be blown away at the number of deer that you can hold on or around your farm if you have the food to support them.
I hope so. I mean, if I had that many deer on my farm, even in the winter, like when you can't even hunt them, I'd just be tickled pink.
Oh, I know. I love it.
I feel like I can't imagine that our deer densities are much different than yours, but I think locally where we are, like there's no egg. There's 300 acres of habitat surrounded by like rural. Summer is finally here, which means hunting season is also going to be here before we know it. So now is the perfect time to be trimming lanes, planting food plots, and putting up some new stands so you're ready when those big bucks start cruising this fall. And if you've been thinking about putting up a new stand on your property, I can tell you it has never been easier with the combination of Maverick hunting blinds and their all-new Elevate platforms. I've got both on my property, and one of my favorite things about the Booner panel blind and the Elevate platform is how easy it is to set them up. Building a deer stand used to be a multiple weekend project for me before, but now with this Booner panel blind and Elevate platform, I can have a new stand up in just one day. I can even get these into every part of my property because they're super light and easy to assemble, yet rock solid when you're on top of that platform. Make sure you roll into this fall confident and ready for those big bucks, because you know you got your stand set up and ready to rock well before season even started. Head over to maverickhunting.com to check out all the options and see why I'm such a huge fan of hunting out of these Maverick platform blinds. And when you check out using the code WESTERNROOKIE, you're going to save 10% on your entire purchase. Housing, so like 5-acre house projects.
Yeah.
And then we have like 800 acres right across the street with no houses. Actually, probably more. It's probably closer to 1,000 or 1,500 acres. We have that reserve. And then we have like 20,000 acres of public land. And it's just like, I know we have a lot of deer, but we don't get a lot of them on our farm, our 40, which is probably understandable. Like, it's not a deer hunting farm. It's a 40 acres with a shop that's close enough to my wife's work.
Yep.
But we can hunt it. Well, I mean, you know what I mean? Like, it's... Yeah. It's a farmstead. It's not like if what I would call like, oh, we're buying this because it's a deer property.
Yeah.
But yeah, I feel like there's got to be that many deer around.
You'll be able to do enough to it, I'm sure, over the years to make it more of that. There's no doubt.
Yeah. What would be interesting is if we added the second feed site.
Yeah.
What that does. Like, are we still seeing the same number of deer on both feed sites? Because like we'll have 10. I think the most we've had in a night is 10, 8 does and 2 different bucks. 8 does in one shot, and then it's pretty easy to be like, oh, well, those two are different. They have antlers.
Yeah.
So that's one, but that's in the backyard, literally like 80 yards from my bedroom window. My wife was literally reading, and I walked and I'm like, oh, there's deer out there. She's like, yeah, they've been there for 2 hours in the middle of the day. Or I'll have a fawn there, and I'll walk from my house, which is probably 100 yards, to the shop, which is probably 70 yards from them, and they'll look at me. And I'll walk into the shop, and then I can like walk to the back of the shop, look out the window, and they'll still be there.
Yeah, oh yeah.
The fawns, the does don't really stick around that long.
Yeah, it's so awesome. We enjoy the heck out of it too. We have we have a food plot right here, 50 yards out the living room window, and I typically run a feeder out there this time of year. And same thing, like I said, tonight, one of the 4-year-old bucks, he shut out, but he was out there with 8 or 10 does, and. Just same thing, like you turn the lights on in the kitchen and they can look in here and see you in here moving around. But they I mean, even him, like just he'll watch for a minute and go back to feeding and no big deal. I love it.
They'll get used to it for sure. Yep. That's why I was curious. Do you have like, so it's your property and you guys have a 60, right?
We have 83, yep.
83, oh, I was more than that. So then your dad's got a property right next door?
Yeah, so our 83 is like a big rectangle, and then in the far back corner my dad owns 40 that connects to me, and his was, they called it the apple orchard. There's like a 40-year-old apple orchard that it's been let go and is all grown up, and like 10 acres of it was planted to trees probably 15 years ago, like row trees,
yeah,
and it's got natives grown up in it, and then the rest of it's just big rolling hills and mature timber. And then to the north, like adjoining he and I, the guy that we bought our farms from, we lease another 60 acres of mostly timber. There's probably 20 acres of tillable on it. So we're definitely fortunate. It's a pretty sweet layout.
Yeah, that is awesome. Especially like 183 acres total. I mean, that's just the playground that you dream about. Especially when you live on site. Like, how nice is it to not have to hook up a trailer to go do something at your hunting property?
It is nice. I will say the downside to it is you're tempted to go all the time. Because it's right out the back door, it's very tempting to want to go do stuff. Like, that's the hardest part, is staying out of it. Like my dad, he's building a house right here beside us, and I look forward to it and dread it all at the same time, because like I tell my wife all the time, we bought this property, we didn't buy it to chase butterflies, and we bought it 100% for wildlife. And so I'm a little bit probably over the top about stuff, like not going outside and jumping on the trampoline at 6 in the evening or whatever. Like, and it's cool, we get by with it, but my dad does not follow the same rules. He doesn't care at all. So I know there's going to be times where there'll be 10 deer out here and he's going to fire up the chainsaw or who knows what, and it just, they'll have to get used to it, I guess. But
yeah, I think I do feel like if you set the boundary, because the other thing is like no one else on your block cares.
Correct.
Like those deer are so used to people in your setting and my setting too, I think. Like they know where the yard is. Like we have a dog, we let the dog out 3-4 times a day. He never leaves the yard though.
Yeah.
And so that's just on him. Like we don't fence collar him anymore. We don't have anything. He just doesn't leave the yard.
Yep.
And so I think those deer know, like, hey, that dog is there, but he never leaves the yard.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
It's weird out.
Yeah. So it's like, we'll have bonfires. We garden, we're outside, we do normal things, and that's what everyone else around us does. I feel like these deer know that.
Yep.
And maybe it makes them a little bit more nocturnal in the backyard food plot. But like
in
the last 3 weeks, it's been 24 hours a day. Deer will come into there for an hour, eat, leave.
Yep.
And so I think you'll be surprised at how smart they get on where the line is.
I hope so.
Yeah. Especially if you have a visual barrier. I mean, I know it's a bummer because you want to see the food plot from the house.
Yep.
But if you just did like maybe even just a row of like sorghum.
Oh, I did. There's already, like, it hasn't grown up yet, but there's two rows of trees, and then the CRP is going to start. So like this year it was still pretty open. Next year though, it'll be like for them a soft edge. In the yard, there's two rows of chestnut and fruit trees, and then there'll be like 30 feet of CRP and then the plot. So I'll be able, like up here. I can look off this. There's a spotting scope right there. I can look off the balcony and I'll be able to see down into it. But if you're downstairs, you won't be able to see into it or from the road. You know what I mean?
I've got the same thing. I got a spotting scope on a tripod right now in my bedroom.
Yep, exactly.
It's funny. Yeah. No, that's exciting. It's going to take us a few years, and we knew that. But I think one of the keys is we are the only ones that are doing anything.
That's right.
Yeah. And so I don't think we're going to grow and hold monster bucks like the Lukowskis, like the Drurys do.
Mm-hmm.
They keep them pretty much on their properties all year long. I think what we're going to end up doing is just attracting the most dominant buck every season. He's just going to move in and call it home because we have the best for you where we live. And he might not be the biggest buck. So I think we're going to have to kind of just get used to like whatever's the biggest here, that's the one we target. We're not going to be able to grow booners. Everyone hunts around here. So I'm not going to like pass a, 125, 130 on this farm because we want booners. Like there's not a great chance we're going to get him to booner.
Mm-hmm.
There's a good chance he's going to get shot.
Yeah.
So, but if he does, the next most dominant buck's going to move in. Like they're just going to, And so I feel like we're just going to be more of like a big buck hotel than a big buck home purchase.
Yeah. And you'll be surprised. Like I've been really surprised and have stressed about it too much, honestly, just because you put so much work into it and care so much about it. But dude, like, we have access to 180 acres right here, but the property north of me, the 60 acres that adjoins our lease north of me, there's a handful of guys that come from the Carolinas every year that lease this. And our firearm season is in the peak of the rut here.
Yeah.
It's 3 weekends, 2 full weeks, and they come up here and they hunt every single day of firearm season, every day. Morning, evening, doesn't matter what the weather is. West of me, there's a couple of guys that own the 22 acres. They hunt really hard. And then the property right here south of me, there's a couple different guys and their kids. So there's a ton of pressure around. And, you know, you go into gun season and all those guys are out more every single day. And it's like, we're not going to have a deer left. But we've tried to play it smart. Like, typically in the last 2 years, I've not hunted firearm season at all,
yeah,
which is tough because it is a fun time to be out and you never know what is going to show up. But like this year in particular, we got hit pretty hard with EHD here this summer. And lost a handful of deer. We were really fortunate because just a few miles away, it was like 80-90% kill off. We didn't have that. We lost a handful. But in early November, my dad and I decided to just call it a season here.
Yeah.
And hope that whatever was alive would make it through. And so I started in November running feed and just staying out. And like this 4-year-old that was out here in the yard tonight, I believe it was opening day of gun season, he moved on to me, and that deer never left my 80 acres. Like, no joke, I had him all hours of the day for 2 weeks straight. It was like he figured out where the pressure was, and there was no pressure here, and I had all the food here, and he didn't leave. And so
yeah,
that's happened a couple of years in a row now where we've gotten somehow, against all odds, gotten 4-year-olds to 5 just by being willing to stay out and eliminate pressure, and they somehow make it. So
they always will. They'll always make it to 4.5 and 5.5. Like, they always sneak through the cracks.
Yep.
Some will get shot. Some will make it. That's hunting.
Yep.
So I agree with you. Yeah, completely. That was probably – we have not shot a deer during gun season on our farm. We hunt it every now and then, and I kind of tried to shoot a doe last year, and it just – this one doe on our farm is super smart. Like, yeah. I'll switch what sides of I was mobile hunting even. I was saddle hunting our food plot, picking the right side each time for the win, and she would like pick me out. I had back cover and everything. And she didn't pick me out, she just knew something was up and would like find different ways each time to walk around the food plot, and I couldn't get a shot at her. No, so sure. I haven't even shot a deer off of our farm yet.
Yeah.
My wife has shot 3.
Wow, that's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the one mistake I made this year is I shot a buck with my bow early, didn't find him. Kind of a heartbreaker story. So I kind of went through the rest of my season as normal, shot a buck with my muzzleloader, and then the next week my brother actually found my bow buck pheasant hunting. He was all eaten up. And
yeah. But,
so then at that point, it really kind of was like, all right, I'm done. Like, I'm not going to – I was still hunting for does for the freezer, but it kind of just really took the mojo off. To kill a deer, you know, after losing one and then not finding it and then later finding it.
Yep.
What I should have done. And then Abby was, she doesn't have a warm season clothes yet. So she really kind of calls it quits as soon as it starts getting real cold.
Yeah.
And she had shot her deer with a bow. I should have started feeding then. I should have started feeding in December.
Yep.
But I didn't get going on building the feeders and getting the feeders out until like first week of January.
Yep.
And so that was a bummer on me. So next year I'm going to probably be ready to go a lot because I got it all now.
Yep.
You know, we bought a new feeder, built the new hay feeder. So now we have it. I'm going to get it out as soon as we call it quits. Now, if we're still chasing big bucks through the end of the year and we got it, then we're going to hold off. But if like, hey, there's nothing on camera. And I'll maybe look at the regs too, like how far away from a feeder you have to be or if it's the whole property. But like, we could feed in the backyard and be like, hey, we're not going to hunt the backyard
anymore. Yep.
And we're going to hunt the other side of the property. But I should probably start feeding as soon as we call it quits.
Yeah, that's what we've done the last couple of years. As soon as I knew for sure we were done, just start feeding. And I feel like it's definitely made a big difference. I mean,
yeah,
there's no doubt.
Do you feel like you've made a difference or an impact on your antler growth?
I don't know. I don't know if I really, so I think overall nutrition plays into that for sure. Like if you have quality food year round and that creates low stress, I think it definitely helps. But like you know, like I love big time. I've used it for years. I believe that it really works in holding deer and like creating patterns of use. But does it help grow antlers? I don't know. Like, honestly,
well,
I know.
I do definitely believe in the epigenetic growth from high nutrition.
Yeah.
Meaning I also 100%, I mean, we know what happens at the deer farms.
Yep.
Right. We've all seen the studies. You take these mini deer from the south and you put them in the same cage with Iowa deer and you feed them the same thing and they both become Iowa deer.
Yep.
So there's 100%. Now, I think the question at play is what we're doing with our off-season food impacting it?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I don't know. I was just wondering, like, did you notice maybe when you moved in, you had lots of, 20% spikes, 60% forks, and then maybe 20% eight pointers as yearlings. And now you're starting to see like all six pointers and eight pointers. Yeah. We don't have any forks anymore.
Yeah. And I mean, again, part of like playing devil's advocate a little bit, part of it is age. When we first bought this, there wasn't a deer over 2 years old. Like I did not hunt it at all for 2 years, period, right. Zero. So part of it was just getting them old enough to express their potential. But yeah, last year, I don't remember if we talked about them or not, but there was a deer that I had him at two, had him at three, and last year he was four and was 173-inch mainframe 10, and he had a third main beam that came up and split like right in front of his face. And he was really regular here. Actually, when I was running the feeder in my plot right out here, out here in the yard plot, yeah. I had several pictures of him in daylight where my house is in the background. That's all you can see is my house. And so he lived here. There was a deer that like lived on me and ended up in firearm season. I don't know what happened. I don't know if somebody shot him with a bow or a gun, but he got shot in the neck and ended up dying. And the neighbor found him and let me have him. So that's how 173-inch deer. But there's been a handful of deer this last couple of years that have gotten to four or five and been like studs like that. There was a 3 year old this year that I know now. I know nobody's ever told me, but I know he died because he lived here all the time. But my dad's never killed a deer and was very much like, I was trying to just get him to shoot one when we were hunting in October. Yeah. And this, he came out, he was 3 year old, but like, dude, giant frame. I'm like 21, 22 inches wide, probably 10, 11 inches tall, like twos and threes, mainframe 10. Just no mass and was young, but 150-inch 9-point.
Yeah.
And dad passed him. And like that deer, dude, he had the potential to be a mega giant. So yeah, we've definitely seen a difference for sure.
Yeah. It's hard to know on the big, it's almost harder to know on the older class deer. Cause would they have done that anyway?
Right.
You know what I mean? It's just hard. I mean, you see the data and I think everyone's kind of realizing it now. Like it took forever for a lot of people to shoot 200s and now they seem to do it every year.
Yep.
You know what I mean? Like, I feel like they've built up the epigenetics, right? Where you get healthier does to offspring, healthier fawns, which grow into even healthier does to have even healthier fawns. And then you have like the even, and then even. And after 10 generations of that, or however long Mark Drury has owned his farm,
right
now it's like, you know, not that hard to grow booners.
Yep.
You know what I mean? Because they're on the, they've got the momentum. It's like compound interest in your 401k. And so it's like, you either have to wait until the end and be like, we've had all these bucks for all these years. And the, you know, it's like, if you just tracked like biggest buck on the farm throughout 30 years, and it's like 140, 142, 139, 148, 140, 149, 150, you know what I mean? You just start incrementally getting it higher. You could do it that way, or else it's like, to me, the immediate one would be like, what are our one-year-olds doing?
Yeah.
Do we have a lot of spikes, or do we have a lot of 8 points?
Yep.
One-year-olds? Because that's like, those are your options. You get spikes, forks, sixes, or eights, basically. And then freaks, like if you have a 12-point one-year-old, that
was a freak.
Keep him alive.
Yeah.
And so that's one of the things I was kind of looking at on our farm, because we do have a fair amount of spikes, little one-year-olds. We have kind of the whole gamut. I don't think we see very many eight-pointers right now. And it probably is pretty respective of what the farm is on its own. Like there's no food around. There's no crops. Yeah. There's no egg. There's no food plotting. Like it's browse deer. It's Northwoods browse deer. Within 3 miles of our house.
Yeah. Which makes a huge, obviously a huge difference in them, their ability to express their genetic potential.
Yeah. And we do see like our top bucks, both years have been like 140 class 10 pointers. We just had probably a 135, 140 class 8 pointer show up brand new after and on the feeder. And then he showed up one day and then he was gone. He was there for like 5 hours. And now I like haven't got a clear enough picture of a big shed buck to know if it's him or not.
Yep.
And so I'm like, where'd it happen? Where'd he go? Yep. Did he shed out? Is he still holding? And so, yeah, we'll see what happens with him. But that's the one metric that I, like, you know, we still have good bucks to hunt.
Yeah.
But yeah, do our 1-year-olds start to take leaps and bounds because we're doing the off-season food? I would love to do like a big tine or anything. We got Domain Mineral out. Yeah. We work with them.
Yeah.
But they don't, it's just the economical side of it. It's like, I think it's just like, you can't afford to go.
No, it's insane, dude.
Yeah. That's what I'm like, these $2 trees are seeming to be a better better.
Yeah.
Gotta wait 5 years, which is the bummer, but
yeah, and that's kind of where I'm at too with like the ability this year to have so much food back there is like I said I believe and love big time. I've used it for years. I'll continue to use it, but even that isn't going to play the kind of impact that leaving 5 or 6 acres of food will, you know.
Yeah, well, I bet you'd be surprised, those 2,000-pound totes.
That's true. That's the first time I've ever done that, and it's been incredible, honestly.
Yeah, because, well, like 5 acres of corn, if it's good corn, are you in like a good egg area?
Oh, yeah.
So you're probably doing 200 bushel corn.
Yep.
But it's probably been – the part they gave you is probably wasn't 200 bushel because it's probably next to the edge where it got hammered all summer by the deer.
Yeah, probably.
But even if it was 150 bushels an acre – 150 bushels weighs just shy of 9,000 pounds.
Yep.
9,000 pounds an acre. So yep.
That's a bunch.
It is a lot. Yeah, I suppose that's 5 totes an acre.
Yeah, and talking about 5.5 acres of that. So that's a lot.
Yeah, it does add up. I wonder, what would be your ideal winter food source for – we could say shed hunting or just overall, because it's kind of the same thing. The best winter food source for shed hunting is what they eat and what lasts long enough for them to be there,
which is
the same as like the best for your deer herd and your deer health.
Yeah.
What's that for you? Like, what does your average snowfall look like? And what is your, like, what would you plant to be like, this is what I would do if I could control everything?
I would have a really tough time picking one thing because it changes so much with the weather. So like here, I mean, the last handful of years have probably been for us like the heavy, where it's been way below average, or like as a kid, way below what we used to get snowfall wise. Like here, okay. This winter, we haven't had, the last several winters, we haven't had more than a couple inches of snow at any one time at all, none. So they've been pretty mild winters overall. This one has been a little, we've got a couple more cold spells. Like right now, the highs this week were all in the teens, lows in the single digits. So some stressful weather. And I would say when it's like this, when there's snow on the ground and it's super, super bitter cold, they're hitting grain, whatever you have, if it's beans or corn. I have done better with beans than corn here. We can't mow corn here and hunt over it. And I do think that makes a little bit of a difference, but overall, if I were to,
it's illegal to plant corn and then mow it and hunt over it.
It is. Yep. Yep. 100%.
So you would have to just do food plot architecture and leave out pockets and hunt the pockets.
Standing corn. Yeah, exactly.
Well, mold, what's your average? What would you say, like, if you had to guess, like, what would you expect your average corn, your snowfall to be?
For an entire year? For the winter? Oh, man.
Like, if you're going to, so for example, for here in Minnesota, I would expect that we're going to get 18 to 24 inches of standing snow at any one time.
Yeah.
Like that's what we typically get. Now we have some year, last year we got none. This year we're really low too, which is abnormal. But for that means like if I plant bulbs and I get them to go, deer don't really dig here. They don't really dig through that, all that snow to get the bulbs out, like the brassicas and the radishes. And so if you were planting a food plot for this purpose, you'd have to keep that in mind. Now, if you're saying like, you know, 6 inches is probably the most we really ever,
which I would say, yeah, that's probably about it.
And that opens up so many options. You can do winter wheat. I mean, they'll probably dig through 6 inches to get to a bulb.
They definitely will. And I've found, like, because we've had a little bit of everything the last few years here, it's really weather dependent. If it's if it's rainy, it's different. If it's warm, it's different. If it's super cold, it's different. That's what I was saying. Like, if it's cold, snowy, they're going to beans.
Carbs.
They're going, exactly. If it's warm, like next week when it warms up and it's in the 40s, they'll be on something green for sure.
Oh, yeah, they'll go to the winter wheat.
They'll be on wheat or they'll be on clover. So it just really depends. But right now I've noticed, like, they'll come, they'll hit that big tine or that standing bean field, which is smoked now. And then they'll come up here and they'll hit these brassicas, and then they'll go up and hit the wheat, and then they'll come back to the feed, and then they'll go to bed. And so it's like, if I could only plant one, it would probably be grain, but we'd be missing some opportunities when it's warmer, I think.
Oh, so you would just do a mix. Yeah, and you have the acres to do it, which is definitely helpful. That's one of the things I've been thinking about. Like, I don't think we'll be able to successfully grow corn in our soils unless we do a ton of tillage, and or not tillage, but drainage. And EPA has some thoughts on that.
Right.
We'll see. I got preliminary approval to dig those ponds.
Yeah, which is
awesome. They said that's a half acre limit per parcel of what you can do for wildlife.
Yep.
And so I was like, okay, can I do this? Can I do that? I'm trying to ask around. And she knows what I really want. And she's like, I see what you're doing. I originally wanted to make roadbeds and ditch them and build up a roadbed so I could drive an ATV around the whole thing. And she's like, you still want to do that? And I'm like, no, I gave up on that. Like, if this is a half acre, like, I want to maximize it for the wildlife, I'll just buy a Ranger with tracks so I can drive through the swamp. She's like, all right, I see what you're doing. But she said the key is there's no depth. It's not a volume of excavation. It's a square footage of excavation.
Yeah.
And so what our farm is like this certain type of muck where it's basically like they say it's up to 80 inches of organic matter that's really packed down and it has really poor drainage. Underneath it is sand. It's supposedly sand.
Yeah.
And my yard is sand.
So weird.
So it makes sense, right? Like it's like sand with lake that got filled in with organic matter and created this like bog marsh over all these years. So what I'm wondering is, if I don't have a depth requirement, can I just get like a 14 foot excavator or 17 foot dig depth? And I'm wondering if I pop down through the organic matter to dig my waterfall ponds down into the sand and open that up, will that be the drainage that we need and start draining off all this excess water? Like, I'm not going to get the whole 40 to turn into a hardwoods.
Right.
But if I can just manage my surface water and my food plots, then it opens up a lot of options.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so, but I don't think I'm ever going to get corn. I do think corn is out of the question. Yeah. And so that's where I'm kind of going to more of like a crimp cover, no-till crimp cover, very dense, heterogeneous mixture, some bulbs, some legumes, some grasses, maybe sorghum. Sorghum might be the one that I would maybe do, and then that keeps it out of the snow at least.
Yeah, absolutely. So. We've had really good luck here too. Another thing I'd do, which especially in hunting season, is I'm sure you've seen people do this, but in our soybean plots, as soon as the first leaf we start to see any sign of turning yellow, we'll go in and broadcast brassicas and radishes into it. And it likely won't get bulbs, but like mine will typically get like 5 or 6 inches tall of greens, and it'll stay green up until like late, you know, December. And I've found that like those tender young plants that grow up under the soybeans, the deer absolutely hammer it all hunting season long.
I bet the only thing our soybeans don't really turn until mid-September, and our first frost dates are like September 30th.
It'd be tough.
So that'd be tough. I think you'd basically only be able to get it to go with wheat.
Yep. Yeah.
Or some type of winter wheat, winter rye.
Yep.
Which would still be great. Yeah. It'd probably even be slightly better because it's going to stay more green and grass like throughout the winter versus the brassicas. As soon as they kind of freeze and thaw, then they die and wilt little bit. That could work even if I could get the soybeans, but just having that that rotation would probably be a good food source. And then like I said, man, I want those mounds. That's what I'm gonna do with the fill, make mounds. Like, I think I talked to the supplier for trees, this nursery, and they're like, I asked about a 5x5 mound 2 feet tall, like, would that be enough if I keep those roots like 18 to 24 inches out of the water?
Yeah.
Like, that should work. And they actually really like organic, high organic matter. So Might really. So I'm hoping, man, that those trees. Plus, like, imagine the picture. Like, I didn't realize I was going to be this much of a homesteader until we bought a homestead.
Yeah.
But now I'm like, I want to do bees, and I built a huge berry garden. We have chickens.
Yep, same.
We have all the things now. And I'm just like, imagine this, like, this, you're in your stand in the spring, and you are looking out, and it's like 110-degree angle of these sectors, and they're all lined by crabapple trees that are, like, full bloom. And you did it like red, white, red, white, red, white, red, white, all the way down. It's just, like, it's not going to work out that good, but I imagine it in my head.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
That'd be like, that would be like the cover of like deer and deer hunting.
Yeah.
Like, look at this dude's food plot.
Yeah.
But you'll lose like that, three of them in a row will die over there. Right. Two of them over there will get killed by a buck. And you know what I mean? It would never look that good, but if it did.
So it'll still look good.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the hope. Yeah, that's the hope. And just see, man, it'd be fun. Like, right now we basically hunt 3.5 acres of our 40 because it's like we haven't had a chance to put work in. And then this summer, it's so wet, we couldn't drive anywhere.
Yeah.
Like, we could get to our woods, and that was it. And so I just did all the projects we could in that woods. I cleared it out. I'll have to send you some before and after pictures of our woods.
Love to see them.
Yeah, but it's like it went from a parkour course to a food plot.
Heck yeah. That's awesome.
Yeah. So I'm excited. I'm really excited for shed season. One of the things I wanted to ask you about, you mentioned potentially doing a trip next year, like whether that's like family and friends or just family, like shed season family. Are you doing any other trips for shed hunting like this year, just privately on your own? Have you got to that point yet?
So we don't really have anything scheduled. One of my best friends and I are hoping to go out west for the first time ever and hunt this coming fall, September. And we've talked about just saying, hey, let's just pick a state and go. Like, once shed season opens, let's go and try to go out west and make a run at finding some sheds. You know, nothing else would be fun to get out in the mountains and hike a little bit. We probably will do that more than likely. Yeah. And I may try to link up with some friends during the Iowa Deer Classic and go somewhere. But aside from that, it'll just be here at home. And that's when we started this, I was telling you, I've had to be patient this year. I don't know how it is where you're at, but like, man, I saw like there was deer shedding early like crazy in Iowa and some of the states out there, but here it has been really slow. Like a couple of the bucks that I really want to find I just got them tonight. They're still carrying, and I'm trying to stay out and wait until most of them have shed, but dude, it's killing me.
Yeah, no, it's hard. I had a buddy that I'm trying to get on the podcast, but he is in, like, I would say northern Minnesota. It would be classified as northern Minnesota. Not all the way to Canada, but up there. He found 3 70-plus-inch antlers, I think, before, like, January 10th.
That's outrageous.
Yeah, and he's like, these are all PRs. Like, I've never found a 70-inch antler. I found three back. Like, the first three sheds he found were all 70-inch antlers.
Oh, my gosh.
He's like, I'm done. Like, I'm not even, you know, hanging
it up.
But he did say all of our deer are shed out really early. And I'm like, I just had a new buck show up with both of his antlers on. Exactly. So I think it is crazy. We've had a pretty mild winter. We've got some cold now, but it's low snow, pretty mild all the way around until just recently here. So I think we probably are starting, but it's also early, dude. Like,
it is pretty early still.
I gotta remember, like, last year we had a 10 pointer in the backyard on March 24th.
Yeah,
so
I know one of the 4-year-olds that I'm really hoping to find this year, we found his set and he shed late March, like that, like 20 something.
Yeah,
I keep trying to remind myself, I'm like, man, we got a long road to go. I'm gonna have to probably at some point just dive in, probably hit it hard like one weekend and look and know that he'll come back in there. But
I don't know, but do you get a lot of rodent damage?
Yeah, oh yeah, a ton.
On your sheds? I've never found a shed with rodent damage.
Oh my gosh, dude, I wish I had them up here. The set that normally sits right here, we're on the ground. We know for sure there's a neighbor had a picture of them. I think it was 10 days later I found the sheds. And like the G2 is almost, if I could break it. Easy. Like, they're so chewed up. Yeah, the squirrels and mice are so hard on them here.
Dang. Okay, so then that is kind of one good reason to get in there.
Yeah, you almost have to. Like, that 4-year-old that was out here that was shed out, we call him Bobo. He shed in mid-January, a month ago exactly now. And I had him, like, had him both sides next day with one side, and 2 or 3 days later, he was here at 6 a.m. with one side and then back at 4 p.m. with shut out. And so I went in and looked anyway for a couple of days. And, like, I didn't go in every nook and cranny, but I looked where I thought they'd be. Could not find them. And I promise you, if I found them right now, unless they're in the middle of a field somewhere, they're chewed up. Promise you. For sure.
Man, that's a heartbreaker.
It sucks.
You know what? Isn't it weird that, like, I just feel like I love antlers so much, but if one is chewed up, it's almost, like, repulsive to
me. It is. Yeah.
Like, I don't even want to look at it. I don't want to pick it. Like, it's just, that's disgusting.
Yeah.
I don't know what it is about it, but luckily, thank God, we don't really get rodent damage here. I don't know why we have squirrels all over the place, but maybe they just eat other stuff. We have a ton of oaks. They're probably just eating acorns.
Yeah. I wish we didn't. We definitely do.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, it's, there's another good deer. I just actually, when I told you I've only found one shed this year, and I really wasn't shed hunting. I drove back to Phil Feeder's and made a run real quick to change some batteries and cameras. And I found this also never happens here, where, like, you probably find sheds often from years previous.
Out west for sure. Yeah.
Like, very, very rarely does that happen here. But in my dad's orchard, where I was telling you they planted it to road trees 15 years ago and it's all grasses in between, I found that good deer shed from last year, and it was very lightly chewed, but it was actually stuck, like, wedged in a sapling. It was almost a hanger. I saw it and snagged it and didn't know who it was until I came home and looked at pictures. I'm like, oh, crap, that's his shed from last year. So,
oh, that's cool.
Who knows? Hopefully they'll start popping here and we'll be able to get out and look for them, because I'm definitely itching to go.
Yeah, I'm hoping my goals for this year are to find the first shed on this farm. We found two deadheads last year. One of them was a crazy buck. Nice, tight, way old, like he's been dead for centuries.
Yeah.
But had, like, triple brows on one side and double brows on the other side, and, like, tight, but just a lot. Like, I would have shot him.
Yeah.
And then we actually lost an 8-pointer we had on camera, which was a bummer. But yeah, first shed on this one. I've only found one shed too, but I also was not shed hunting. I was driving to Iowa to buy a brush hog for our tractor, and I was on the interstate. And I was like, I remembered where it was. I was like, okay, it's, like, right after the Menards. And so I got back and I'm, like, looking and I'm looking, and now it's in the other lane. And I looked and I saw it, and I'm like, yeah, I'm not turning around for that one.
Yeah.
Like, it was a yearling 4-point, or a yearling, you know, 4-point side of, you know, it's probably 30 inches. I'm not flipping the tractor. I have elevated in my shed hunting career. Someone else can find that one.
That's right. Exactly.
Yeah. So no, I let that one lay. So
I actually did the same thing. I guess I've technically found two. Last week, one day I was driving out here, the reservoirs I was telling you we'd like to host something on, and found a road shed, and I looked it up, and, like, being the law abiding citizen I am, looked it up, and the guy that owns it lives out of state, and I had an idea of the person that may farm it. It was still standing corn. Their combine broke, and they never got the corn out of it, and it's absolutely decimated. So I called the farmer, and I asked him, like, hey, do you farm this? And he's like, yeah, I do. And I told him I spotted a shed off the road and asked if I could shed hunt it. And he's like, man, I really can't give you permission. They lease the hunting rights, and I'm not sure if the guy would care. But he's like, he goes to Florida for the winter, and he's like, I feel weird about giving you a cell phone number randomly. So basically it was a no. He's like, if there's a shed right off the road and you can grab it, I wouldn't worry about that. You can get it, but I just haven't been back over to get it. So wasn't going to risk anything. It was same thing. It was a little 4-point side. That'd probably be 30 inches. And I'm like, at the end of the day, somebody else can find it and trespass and get it.
Yeah, no, it's a good time, man. I'm excited. It's going to start here soon. Every year I try to find 100. Last year I was woefully short, but one of these seasons, I'm going to try to make it happen.
Yeah. Absolutely. We need to try to link up one of these days here.
Yeah. When is the Iowa Deer Classic?
It is March 6th, 7th, and 8th, I think. 7th, 8th, 9th, 7th, something like that. Yeah.
In Des Moines?
Yeah. In Des Moines. Yeah.
Yeah. I might have to drop down for that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Drop down. You could hit up Jenny and Tyler.
Yeah.
Probably go out shed hunting. They've probably found them all in
Des Moines. I guarantee they have. Yeah,
there's no more left. They'll put a couple out for us.
Right. Yeah, stage them. Whatever it takes.
Awesome. Yeah, let's stay in touch. We definitely need to meet up, especially if you guys do, like, a shed camp next year, a east one and a west one. That would be really fun. I think
I really want it to happen. I've talked to a few of the partners about it, and, like, dude, it's, I don't know. I had the opportunity to go to Winter Strong last year. Do you know what that is?
No.
So Bert Soren, that owns Sorenx Fitness Equipment, he hosts it every year, and it's very similar to that, where there's people from the fitness community and the outdoor industry that all come, and they have like Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, where they'll host a little camp on that. And there was an ex-NFL player that was there talking about like cold, you know, recovery stuff, cold plunging and then heat therapy and just all different camps. And the first, that was the first couple of days was that stuff. And dude, it was a blast. And then they had a little bit of a, like a fitness competition that was a little bit of shooting, a little bit of fitness. And so like, you know, TJ and I have talked the last few years, but to do something similar to that with all the people we've met in the shed hunting community and host an actual, you know, an event and be able to shed hunt for a couple of days, I think would be incredible. So we'll make it happen.
Dude, I got some ideas for you. We'll talk about them offline.
Yeah, let's do it.
Yeah, yeah. That's, let's keep in touch on that one. But I do have to jet.
Yep.
I told my wife what time dinner would be. I'm getting better at this whole podcast after 200 episodes of figuring out what time we'll wrap up. Absolutely. So awesome. Well, thanks for being on the show again, Dwayne. Before we do break, give folks that haven't been listening where they can find you, what shed season's all about. Give them the whole spiel.
Yeah. Yep. So biggest platform is Instagram. We have Facebook, Instagram, all the things. We have the website, shedseason.com. So Shed Season is just a platform to share and consume shed hunting related content. We try to continuously put stuff out there and reshare other folks, you know, posts and stories and stuff like that. But every year, the biggest thing is we host a giveaway, have a lot of really great partners. And this year, more so than ever, I think the giveaway is like over $20,000 worth of stuff. So that started now. You just go to our website to enter, and there's going to be three winners at the end of it here. It'll be mid-March. I believe it runs for 6 weeks. And so, yeah, really excited to give away some stuff from awesome partners. We're just hoping to continue to grow up from here organically. We've met so many awesome people and have you know, grown a bunch of friendships and relationships through it. And so just looking to build on that. So, yeah, find us. Shed Season is the Instagram and Facebook. And, yeah, man, we're excited.
Yeah, it's also some dope apparel.
Yeah, we do have really awesome apparel. Actually, TJ just reminded me today that we do have really awesome apparel. So, yeah. You check that out too.
Apparel. Yep. Shirts fit good. Cool designs, cool hats. Couple products out there as well. In the like product space, we got the shed straps.
Yep.
What are these called?
Those are called quick straps.
Quick straps?
Yeah.
Personally can vet that they can hold like 6 to 8 elk antlers with flying colors, probably more. I just only have 6 to 8 elk antlers.
Yeah.
I'm excited to check those suckers out this year.
Yeah.
Because I don't want to electrical tape sheds together.
No. Cool little backstory on this. The 18-inch version of that, our GM at Novix actually hung off of a basketball goal with two of them. So, that like, you literally almost can't break them. They're incredibly strong. But, yep, that. And then if you need a way to display antlers, Rack Hub, obviously. We have RH1, RH2. So, lots of cool stuff. You know, we try to dream up the stuff that we would like to have, and TJ designs and builds it and brings it to market. So we have all kinds of neat stuff.
I have a blessing and a curse that I've gotten to TJ's inner circle. Well, he will share ideas with me early.
Yeah.
But then I know how cool they are and I can't talk about them for like 6 months.
That's right.
Exactly. So cool stuff. But yeah, go check out Shed Season, get entered to draw, pick up some of the dope apparel, coolest hat ever. I got hundreds of miles on this one. I think this hat has got its grand slam.
Love
of a mule deer, a whitetail, and an elk.
Can't beat that.
Yeah. So.
Heck yeah.
We'll donate it to the Shed Season giveaway if you'd like.
That's right. Exactly. Autograph it.
Yeah. No one wants my autograph, but yeah. Once again, thanks for being here, Dwayne.
Thanks for
listening.
This episode is brought to you by Peloton. Break through the busiest time of year with the brand new Peloton Cross Training Tread Plus. Powered by Peloton IQ. With real-time guidance and endless ways to move, you can personalize your workouts and train with confidence.
helping you reach your goals in less time. Let yourself run, lift, sculpt, push, and go. Explore the new Peloton Cross Training Tread Plus at onepeloton.com.
President's Day savings are happening now at the Home Depot with up to 40% off select appliances. Looking to upgrade your fridge? Check out LG's newest model, serving up ice in all kinds of styles. Cube, crushed, craft ice, and now new mini craft ice straight from the dispenser. From cold brew to fizzy favorites, these refrigerators will have you entertaining like a pro. Shop President's Day savings and get up to 40% off, plus free delivery on select appliances like LG at the Home Depot. Free delivery on appliance purchases of $1,498 or more. Offer valid February 5th through the 25th, U.S. only. See store online for details.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.